Hi, this is Father Bill W., and I want to welcome you to another one of our podcasts. I'm an Episcopal priest living here in Austin, Texas. I have had the gift of recovery since December 27th of 1972, so I'm working close to that 50-year mark. It's been quite a journey, let me tell you. The idea behind these podcasts is to try to go deeper into spirituality and also into the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it came to be. That made a tremendous difference for me. Around 20 years sober, I got dunked into the history big time and really changed my life. So discovered a thing called two-way prayer. It's the way many of the pioneers were approaching what we would call the 11th step, and listening to God. Sounds strange at first, but really changed me in a very dramatic way. So I encourage you to visit our website. It's by the same name, Two Way Prayer. It'll teach you the process. I also do workshops on this once a month, and you can get directions to that from the website, or you can write me at twowayprayer@gmail.com. If you're on the website, do be sure to sign up for the newsletter. My guest today is Matt D. He is an old friend. And those of you who are familiar with the podcast, he did a marvelous explanation guiding us through a book called Invitation to a Great Experiment. It was written by Tom Powers, and Tom was very instrumental in the early days of AA, helped Bill Wilson write the 12 and 12. Many of you are familiar with that, AA Comes of Age, and the second edition of the Big Book. So he was a huge influence there. And when I did the series of podcasts with Matt, at the tail end, I said, I want to have you back sometime and discuss a pamphlet, a little booklet that got my attention in the late 70s. It was like, ooh, this makes sense for me. I was fairly new to sobriety then, but even then, I knew it was an important piece of literature. So, Matt, it's great to have you back. And if you could start off by telling us a little bit, the name of the article is Gresham's Law and AA. So you might begin by filling us in on where is this coming from in terms of Gresham's Law? What's the meaning behind that?
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is always it's just a delight, you know, to talk back and forth. I enjoy just doing it when we're not being recorded, and it's kind of nice when it is recorded.
We clean the language up a little bit when we get that's the tape rolling.
That's the only unfortunate part of it. But jumping into on the title, the article was written in 1976 in a magazine called 24 Magazine, which was obviously anybody in the fellowship sees a reference to 24, meaning the hours of the day, which are the hours in which we're to work towards, you know, spiritual development, our spiritual life, conscious contact, and to do it one day at a time. You know, it's got implications in the thing of now, you know, dealing with life now. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so there was a magazine that was published. It came out of a group effort, started out as a drying out place for alcoholics with some opening for people with other addictions. This is the 1960s. The place was founded by Tom Powers Sr., who we just mentioned earlier, writing the book Invitation to a Great Experiment. A bunch of his AA buddies that were all, many of them, instrumental in helping with AA's headquarters, or was the accountants for AA. And, you know, he had some very high level AA persons that helped with the, you know, general services and publications and stuff. He also was helped by his son, Tom Jr., who is the author of the piece Gresham's Law and Alcoholics Anonymous. And the drying out place kind of turned into a spiritual community over a number of maybe 5, 6, 7 years. People who came in to get dried out ended up buying homes in the area and helping out with the people that were coming through. And before you knew it, they ended up with a school and for children, and, you know, became a full-fledged spiritual community based around the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was Tom's, it's like St. Thomas Hospital was to Dr. Bob. It's like, this is Tom's effort to communicate 12 steps in a certain kind of setting. Part of the ways of communicating was Tom was a publication guy. He was writing all kinds of things and editing and so forth. He created and published, if you will, his own magazine. And in 1976, actually, I should back it up. I'd say in 1975, Tom had been diagnosed with lung and liver cancer and was deathly ill. When I say deathly ill, I mean literally at death's door. And he had been the main driving force behind this publication. And for about a couple of years, he had to work seriously on his health. He did an alternative form of treatment that was very extensive, and it was a metabolic thing. And he ended up becoming cancer free and living to the age of 93 years old. But while he was recovering, his son had taken over the publication, and he put out about 5 or 6 little magazines. There were small little things. He knew he couldn't do the extent of what his father was doing. And he wanted to publish something that talked about a trend that was, it's a dual thing. It's a trend that occurs in all spiritual movements and particularly occurred in AA. But also, more importantly, is a trend that happens in each person's individual life. For instance, the 12 steps to get sober, you know, you come in, you start to really do what you're told, you're humbled, you go through a period of purgation and ego deflation, and before you know it, things start to re-knit a little bit, and then you have this tendency to kind of play around and hedge your bets, and, you know, do I really need to do this inventory work, or do I really need to do this prayer time, or do I really need to do this or that? So in essence, the piece is referring to a trend that occurred in AA where AA started out, where people took the whole program incomplete. And you read, read Dr. Bob and you'll see, like, you know, in order to get in, that you had to do a surrender, a complete surrender, that you made a commitment that you were going to do this thing 100%. Mm-hmm. Over time, what happened is, you know, again, you start to, you know, a little less and a little less. And so this article is about this, what's occurred in the movement, and divided into 3 kinds of AA. So it's strong AA. And I'll give you the spell out, and I'll get back to your original question in a second.
Yeah.
But it's strong AA, which is, it says here, the 3 ways to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, the strong original way proved powerfully and reliably effective over at the time that this was written, 40 years. 2, a medium way, not so strong, not so safe, not so sure, not so good, but still effective. And 3, a weak way, which turns out to be really no way at all, but literally a heresy, a false teaching, and a twisting and corruption of what the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous clearly stated the program to be. So the original title of this piece, and Tom Jr. was acting as the, you know, the Aaron, if you will, or the mouthpiece for his father. The original title was called What's Your Cup of Tea? Meaning the strong, medium, and weak, in reference to strong, medium, and weak AA. Mm-hmm. And his father was still involved to some extent. You know, he looked over the copy, and he sent back the working title as Gresham's Law and Alcoholics Anonymous. And Tom Jr. scratching his head, who the hell is Gresham? What is his what is his law? And the subtitle still held with the "What's Your Cup of Tea?" Essentially, he said he had to go look it up, but Gresham was the economist, I guess, for Elizabeth I. And essentially, his principle is that good currency drives out bad. Essentially, that debased currency, paper, drives out gold, in essence. And I'm not an economist. And if you could look at my checking account, you could figure that out. But essentially, it's referring to a currency, which I find very interesting, because in a way, that's a thing that happens in the 12-step program. Well, we don't call it currency, but there's a certain thing that you are given, if you will, and it is no value to you if it's sitting in a bank. It's a thing that requires you to give it to other people.
Yeah, it's, it's kind of like grace.
It is like grace, very much.
Yeah.
And it is, it's a currency, it's a power, and it's of no value if you keep it to yourself. Not only does the other person profit from you transmitting this currency, but you do too.
Right.
And so it's a very interesting title, how that thing worked out.
Yeah. You know, to go back to the big book, just to kind of get us warmed up here, there's always been a tension when I read it, and it's a kind of a back and forth. It's this is just a suggestion. We think, we recommend this. We think it might be helpful. And then other times it's, well, you damn well better do this or you're going to die.
You know? Yeah.
So, I mean, you read it and it's subtle, but both of those elements are there. Wouldn't you agree to that?
Absolutely. You can see the dichotomy between that. And anybody who delves in, you see like the intensity of like the original communication,
right,
was very strong. And then, you know, Tom said this at one point, said that they were so keenly concerned about the transmission of this currency, if you will.
Yeah.
And that they knew that, boy, you did not want to lay any kind of unnecessary difficulty on your brother alcoholic to have to digest something more than was necessary. They were very concerned about it. And so there's a piece about sugarcoating the pill, I guess he calls it.
Right.
And you can definitely see that in the big book if you really are looking at it. You know, like you're saying, in one sense, it's like, you know, Dr. Bob level, do this or else or you're going to die, if you will. And then the next thing, it's like, this is a suggestion.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Here's a quote I took out from the article. It says, when Bill first formulated the 12 steps, he conceived of them as instructions, not as suggestions. When the idea of presenting the steps as suggestions came up, Bill for a long time flatly opposed it. Finally and reluctantly, he agreed. In AA Comes of Age, he related how this concession enabled countless AAs to approach the fellowship who would otherwise have been turned off to AA and back to active alcoholism. The softening, it's both a blessing and a curse. You know, it allows people to come in, but if they stay there at that level, that's when the danger starts to appear.
Totally. And ingrained in the concession is this ironclad responsibility that you elect for yourself, strong AA. Like you can do this thing any way you want to, but along with the concession that allows more people to enter, if you will, it also heightens the personal responsibility. Like, I got to do this thing the whole way, and that falls on me.
Right. And then in the 1940s, the article makes the point that there was an inundation of newcomers into the program when the publicity started to come about, and it was sort of the beginning of cafeteria style, take what you want and leave the rest, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just magnified over the years.
Absolutely. It definitely. I mean, and so in the early days, and you know the history very well, but AA is a movement that is being born out of another movement. And I've been studying the King School group and stuff recently more than I have in a while.
That's the Akron original
Akron meeting. Group. It's AA group number one. It's Dr. Bob's home group. Yeah. And we had the benefit of one of our early members of East Ridge go out and interview the secretary of that group and get an idea what that group was like. It was very intense. He made the point, you know, Dr. Bob, in order to get in, you had to make a full surrender. It was a condition, like this later condition of a honest desire to stop drinking. And then they even dropped that. It just became a desire to stop drinking. I mean, that's always been implied. But at the same time, in the early days, it required a surrender. Like, you got on your knees and you admitted all your faults and you listened to someone else share about their own faults and weaknesses, and you made a commitment in your surrender that you were going to spend the rest of your life trying to make that right and help other people.
It's pretty simple, straightforward, but intense.
Very intense.
Very intense.
Very intense. Yeah. So eventually what happened is when this thing ended up exploding, if you will, on the scene, you know, it wasn't possible to have that same level of intensity or intensity that comes off of intimacy. Like, you know, you worked with Dr. Bob, you were close. Now, all of a sudden it was like you were being taken through this process with somebody who just got in 2 weeks before. And so a whole new development occurred in the movement.
And there's that wanting people to come in, you know, and as a result of that, wanting it so much that we're going to soften the message.
Yeah. I think there is something, Dr. Bob alludes to this in his last major talk. He says that at the time, certain kind of suffering that was going on, like people were really down and out. Yeah. In the 1930s.
Yeah.
I mean, they were tough. I got to know Sue, Dr. Bob's daughter. She said that they only had two pairs of clothes. She said that the clothes they had on and the ones that were being washed. And, you know, this nowadays, if you were a physician, you know, you'd have two houses and boats and cars and everything else. Right. And they were really down and out. And he said that there was something to that. Like, you couldn't fart around with the program. You had an ally, if you will. That there wasn't all this kind of forgiveness and leeway. If you didn't get sober, your family went out on the street. And there was an intensity that was in the circumstances there that you really needed to get this thing. Along with what happens as a movement, you know, it also follows the culture a little bit. I don't mean to get into talking about that stuff too much.
No, that's okay.
But as things started to change themselves, and then especially, you know, I mean, you go out of the 30s into the 40s and 50s. And by the time you get to the 70s, when this article was written, it was very clear. Most of this he had about that book and putting it together. Tom Jr. tried to condense and again, working as a mouthpiece, put into this article. That's the background for a lot of this, for this piece, really. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's go through the three stages and love to have you comment on them. So what is strong AA? What is medium AA? And then what is the weak version? How do they differ?
Well, strong AA, I think it's to literally take the program the way that it was originally practiced and then also communicated. Again, there are places throughout the big book where you see that they had softened things. And again, for a very good reason. And the individuals responsible, again, for electing what's going to work for them. But I would say that strong AA is to take the 12 steps, not just in themselves, but to take them along with what we call in AAA the 10 points. And it's like, you know, if you're going to bake a cake or something, you've got the materials necessary to bake that cake, but you also have directions to tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. And the materials devoid of the directions can end up with a real mess. And I think that's the thing that strong AA does, is it really weds the 12 steps into how it tells you to do it in the big book. And this is material, if you will, that is coming off of intense spiritual movement and experience. Like, these people were, they went from being, you know, in a gutter to be, I'm not saying they're saints or anything, but the intensity of the spiritual rigor that's there is it's immense. And they're communicating that at a very critical time. And that does make it into the book. It really does. So,
yeah. And if, you know, I just finished the series on William James, and so I'm kind of fresh from that. But James talks about the sick soul, almost at the depths of the personality, at the depths of the psyche. And when that sick soul comes in contact with other people who have been sick souls, you know, and know they have found a way out, I mean, that attraction is tremendous. It's
absolutely
desperate. It's the gift of desperation, as we call it in the program.
Yeah. And I think it's again, to talk about how difficult the times were, I think it's because there's an ally in the sense that it's the level of purgation. Like, these people were absolutely flattened. I mean, they weren't being propped up by a bank account or a government or a rehab or whatever. Like, they had no resources at all. And I'm not knocking resources. Thank God we have.
No, they're nice. They're nice.
Thank God
they're
we
comfortable.
Have them. And yet at the same time, they too have a downside, if you will, or an effect.
That's right.
So if you don't mind, indulge me for a second, I'll read you what the 10 points are. These are just, Tom Sr. pulled them out of the big book.
Yeah.
It says the 10 points represent the spiritual inspiration and guidance for how to work the 12 steps as given by the first 100 AA members. These original commitments are the spiritual legacy and heritage of the first men and women whose sacrifice, wisdom, and trial and error experience became solidified in the How It Works chapter of the AA Big Book. For many addicts, lesser commitments to the program do not offer the crucial momentum necessary to reach the level of spiritual awakening required to attain true freedom. Mm-hmm. Make no mistake about it, every person who adopts the rigor and intensity of the 10 points will be rocketed into a new dimension of existence. We commit ourselves to work toward recovery and spiritual awakening through sincerely and responsibly trying to do what the AA Big Book suggests by 1, completely giving ourselves to this simple program, 2, practicing rigorous honesty, 3, being willing to go to any lengths to recover, 4, realizing that there is no easier, softer way, 5, being fearless and thorough in our practice of the principles, 6, letting go of our old ideas absolutely, 7, recognizing that half measures will not work. 8, asking God's protection and care with complete abandon. 9, being willing to grow along spiritual lines. 10, accepting the following pertinent ideas. A, that you cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can restore you to sanity. C, that God can and will if sought. And that, in essence, is what strong AA is.
Absolutely. Beautiful, beautiful. I'll try to put that into the show notes, if you'll send me a copy.
Yeah, I certainly will.
Yeah. And then medium AA. So what happens after a period of time? They take that strong thing, and then what happens to it?
Yeah, again, this is a representation of what occurs in a movement, but happens in everybody's life. I mean,
it's every spiritual organization.
And it's the thing about it is I may wake up in strong AA and I might be in medium AA by, you know, in a half an hour, you know.
That's right. So it's not just the organization, it's also reflected in the life of the individual.
Exactly. And I think if any organization at all was to be revitalized, if you will, it happens because individuals are taking the commitment seriously, personally,
right,
individually,
right,
you know. So weak AA is in essence, it's just an accommodation to strong AA. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I'll take most of this aboard, but some of it that I find uncomfortable, you know, I won't, you know, maybe I'll do inventory periodically or prayer time periodically, or check in with somebody about where I'm at on the program only when, you know, things are getting tough. I hesitate to mention meeting attendance or something, but because the truth is weak AA is almost pure meeting attendance. But medium AA is to, you know, is to take the pill and cut it in half, in essence.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the beginning, the pioneers felt if you worked that kind of a program, you were going to get drunk. But over time, they saw, well, look, people are working that kind of a program. They're not getting drunk. They may be crazy as hell. They may be into all sorts of other addictions, you know, but they're not getting drunk. It's possible. Hey.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they were, and in another way, I'm not saying that the piece itself is flawed, but to say that AA was just pure strong AA from the very beginning is not necessarily the case. It's just that at that time, if you weren't doing strong AA, you had an extremely good chance that you weren't going to make it. Like, that's just the kind of addict they had in AA at that time and the circumstances behind them. But when they had a guy like Jimmy B came in and he was, you know, he had his anti-God talk and he got up and he was speaking and stuff. They were all like, as Bill Wilson said, you know, they had a rally of all the brothers in the corner about what to do about Jimmy B. Jimmy Burwell ended up actually kind of showing them. He went off and ended up, as Bill said, on his psychological program, broke wide open, and he ended up in a terrible drunk. And then became something of a God believer, you know, at that point, and ended up being able to take aboard the parts of the program that he had. He went from, in essence, he went from medium AA to strong AA, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The article also, Matt, goes into the difference between the quality of the language, the intensity of the language in the first 164 pages versus the language that we find in the appendix, where it moved from experience to what Wilson called a more tepid version of awakening, you know? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting thing. Again, this is like anything that happens in a movement happens to an individual. And it's I know I keep going back to this Genesis account, and maybe it doesn't apply very well here. But you start out, you recognize a certain level of development when something becomes introspective, when it starts to think about itself as a thing. Right. For the first 4 years of AA's existence, it didn't even have a name. Right. It wasn't concerned with itself as a movement. It wasn't concerned with itself at all. It was concerned with the work of carrying this message to other people. And there was no organizational aspect to it. Right. At some point, you start to organize and you're like, we got to get this stuff down. We got to get it in book form. They thought they had to get a bunch of hospitals involved and a number of stuff. And you start.
This is the machine stage.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And you start to organize and you start to put things down. And this is what tends to happen, if you will. And originally AA was not very concerned at all with itself. What was your question a second ago? Because I'll tie it back in. It is a natural movement that occurs. Again, it's done at a, I don't want to say downgrading of the intensity of it. Thank God that we had this process where they got it down, and thank God they were concerned how it was going to lay on other people. And yet, the strength is diminished by its length, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a concern for quantity.
Yeah.
You have to have the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, and that drives out the quality.
So you're going to drop the four absolutes because that's offensive. Although they didn't drop it in Akron, they kept them all the way right through. And Dr. Bob said 2 years before he died, like, these things hold good, like, hang on to these things.
That's right.
But they're going to downgrade words like spiritual experience to spiritual awakening. They're going to do these things in concern for their movement and how their movement can help others. They're still thinking about how they're going to help others,
right?
Without a doubt. But this is the regular trend that occurs.
I mean, you see it in the churches, you see it in treatment centers, you see it in people. Fourth stage is the machine, where the lawyers are present, and we're starting to count the numbers at the board meetings. And then the fifth is the mausoleum, because it's dead. And that's the phases that these things go through. Until another individual comes along, you know, like yourself. I'd say on behalf of myself, for you, who gets it and then wants to communicate it and not screw it up. Very difficult.
Yeah, and it's all unnecessary. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's like studying the biological life of an animal or insect.
That's right.
Insect or something. I mean, these are developments that are just going to happen. And there's a thing that out of the fourth way school, they say that a thing will become its opposite unless it has a conscious shock. And I take that to mean spiritual awakening. Like this thing's got to be constantly under, you know, hypnotic condition of sleep. Like we're always falling asleep. You know, you forget. Yeah. Like, you know, you just keep forgetting. Although I very much do like the term spiritual experience, I also think there's something in spiritual awakening as well, because it's like fulfillment, or the fulfillment of this program is awakening. It's not like, okay, you do this and you end up sober. It's saying like, it's awakening. In reverse, it means our problem is spiritual sleep, in a way. That's what's wrong with us in a certain sense here. And strong AA is about trying to regularly stay awake and to rely on other people who are staying awake around you. At times, you know, I fall asleep and that guy next to me is awake. He gives me a nudge, and vice versa. Weak AA is to, it's a condition of being on the razor's edge, and you're always going to be pulled. The problem with weak AA, and we're all in it, but the problem with weak AA is always pulling you. I mean, medium AA is that it's always pulling you into weak AA. Right. It's just, that's the problem. And if you aren't constantly around, trying to move towards strong AA, you're going to get pulled. Mm-hmm. You're going to get pulled.
Yeah, it's like an undertow. Two results are pointed out in the article. One is, by allowing this pull, by falling into it, we're going to see lower recovery rates than we did in the beginning. Yeah, yep. That was the first. And then the second was how old timers, that we don't see as many old timers, or the quality of the life of the old timers is not what it could be and maybe perhaps should be.
That's a shame. Like, yeah. That's the part, that's the worst part of it altogether, in my view, is to see there's so many people who come in and, you know, 10 years in, and they may not be drinking, but their spiritual lights are so dim.
Yeah.
Their joy is gone, you know, and then they're beset with depressions and self-pity and despondency and resentments
and rigidity.
Rigidity is this aspect coming off of the fear, just totally overwhelmed. These and honestly, it is the underlying, what we call in AAA, the underlying character defects that flourish under the cover of our primary addiction. This is what, when you read chapter 5, they're getting you into these conditions that are behind it. You know, you're dealing with dishonesty and fear and self-will and selfishness. It's like, if strong AA and even medium AA on its higher end is having you work and deal with that, weak AA can't touch any of that. Like, right. you need something with the deep intensity to deal with, where you start to get to the real spiritual faults of a person. You know, weak AA can't touch it. There's a thing that Tom had said. He was saying that, you know, just what you said about how you can, there are people who come in, are sober off the power of the pack, if you will, and they don't drink. And they tend to be, again, ones that make their prop, if you will, becomes a social thing. They tend to just hang around AA quite a bit, but he says this: the truth is, however, that the idea that you can get relief from the addiction by a weaker approach is really an illusion. Mm-hmm. All you get is relief from the addictive substance. The killing spiritual faults behind it are not relieved by weak AA. You just get into a kind of compromise with it, and the bill comes due in later years. And the people who quietly fade out of the fellowships, no problem, no complaint, just fade out, is large, and that's unfortunate. And that's true. That's true.
Yeah. One of the best meetings I've ever went to was in Ohio. It was formulated in three stages. First, the kid came out. The kid of the alcoholic came out and told his or her story, what it was like living in the home before and after, and honestly. And then the spouse came out and told the same story. And it was only then that the alcoholic was allowed to come out. And by that time, you know, if he or she tried, you know, a line of BS, it wasn't going to fly. It wasn't going to fly. So there's something about this strong, and that was what the article brought to life for me. When I first read it, I knew this was an important piece of literature. It's not specifically AA literature, but it's on the edge of it, just like the Four Absolutes are on the edge of it. When you were talking about the changes that needed to be made, my mind went right to the Absolutes. That's step 6 and 7. That's the heart of the program.
Yeah.
You know, it's the other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And strong AA, like the point you were making a minute ago, strong AA is family AA. It's like it's brought into your family. I mean, it is the principles by which you live. It is like, I'm going to use these principles at my job. I'm going to use them in my family. I'm going to use them in the exchange between myself and the lady at the cash register at the grocery store. It is absolutely all parts of your life. It is to take the program, the parts of the program seriously, where it says, you know, in all these defects of character, or your whole will and life, or in all of my affairs. It's like, you're going to do this thing everywhere at all times. This is the aim and the goal of strong AA, and throughout your entire day and life, and all elements and aspects of your life. Weak AA is to live your life based on your wishes and wants and so forth. It is not to have some higher set of principles that you're trying to live by. It is that life is supposed to revolve around you, and that always leaves you frustrated. You know, you step on the toes of your fellows. It's on and on and on. Every addict knows what that's like, because they were pouring booze or whatever their addictive substance is on top of it just to be able to live. Yeah. You know, but if you come in and you don't actually work towards some kind of restoration of sanity of those underlying defects, then where the hell is the relief? Right. I mean, in a way, weak AA is worse than drunkenness, because at least there's some kind of relief. Now, of course, you drink, you may very well die and take somebody out with you. But our own spiritual intuition knew, before we knew any of this stuff, that we needed some kind of spiritual dimension where we were going to get relief. And you cannot get that in just hanging out at a meeting, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. You only get it by trying to take this way of life, the way that it was originally spelled out, and have a deep commitment to it, and to try to practice it the way that they said to practice it.
Right. And for some people, if they don't do that, they're going to die. You know, I think there are people in AA who, and any 12-step program, for whom it is not life and death. And yet for some, it is absolutely life and death.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think principle plays out in the different fellowships that are out there. The sex recovery fellowships have a harder time because, you know, you go on a binge or something and you may be groggy or whatever, but you still get yourself together and you can go to work or whatever the next day, you know. But man, if you're on some kind of hard substance. It's like, you got to get this. Just, again, it's the conditions of the 1930s. It's like, you got to get this or you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't play around with weak AA. It's like, right. You got to do the whole thing, period.
Yeah. Yeah. I thank God for teachers in the program. I had some tough teachers, you know, but if I hadn't had them, I wouldn't be here today with nearly 50 years sober. I mean, they sent me to live in the Salvation Army to raise my bottom. It's like, you got to get this, kid, or you ain't going to make it.
Yeah. You know? And you have to develop to the place spiritually, if you're going to get anywhere, to where you can't just rely on external circumstances to squeeze the crap out of you.
Right.
You know what I mean? So this squeeze the crap out of me, and now I'm going to be open and I'm going to do my prayers and do this stuff. It's like, to get, this is why medium AA happens, in my view, if you're setting out to practice strong, because at a certain point, you know, all the pressure of the memory of the crisis that was just you last had starts to evade and
you fall asleep again.
Then you fall asleep. Exactly that. And if we are to grow spiritually and become sons, if you will, and daughters of God, it's like, we got to work a day at a time to incorporate ourselves into a way of life that's going to help wake us up on a regular basis. Like, that's our responsibility. Some people come in, you see it happening, where some people come in and they stay sober for a couple of years, then they get drunk. They stay sober for a couple of years, then they get drunk. Mm-hmm. It's they've never worked past this period where they had developed the muscle. It's just a reactionary thing. Life squeezed me and now I'm going to do what I got to do. I got to do the right thing for a little while.
Yeah.
Like some point you got to grow up past that. That's strong AA.
Growing up. That's another whole podcast we need to do, is the emotional growth that is required.
Yes.
And the spiritual support for that emotional growth, because they kind of go hand in hand.
They sure do.
Yeah. Well, listen, Matt, this has once again been a wonderful and instructional piece. I think AAA has contributed greatly to that. So we're going to put the 10 points. Wonderful to reflect on those each morning during your quiet time. And a link to where you can get this article called Gresham's Law. So, Matt, thank you for coming back for this follow-up and for the work you're doing out there in the world. It's really a blessing to many. So,
yeah, absolutely. And it's a real pleasure. And I didn't say this, and I know we're winding it down, but I hit this article at a critical time. It absolutely is a central document, changed my life at a time where it's just such a critical period. I had always thought of addiction up till that point as though I was a victim of it. And now I found out that the responsibility on how my life was to be was mine. You know, it's right. You're responsible for your own recovery. And this makes it very clear. So it was an honor to be able to talk about it. And I hope it was helpful to the listeners.
I'm sure it was. Hey, thank you so much, Matt, once again. And for our listeners, thank you for tuning in. God bless. And